Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. And today is episode 201 with the title, Healing Through Human Connection. And I have the absolute honor and privilege to welcome Sylvia Kelso and Adrian Arensa. Sylvia and Adrian are the co-founders of Lead and Belong, creating gentle yet powerful spaces for leaders and teams to shift from mind-centered approaches to truly human-centered growth. When I asked Sylvia and Adrian to describe their superpower, they said, "This is just piercing insight paired with calm, steady energy needed to hold challenging, transformative conversations." Hello, Sylvia. Hello, Adrian. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Lovely to have you here. And I believe that you got in touch having listened to an episode I recorded with Cheryl Miller recently. So thank you for that.
It was a beautiful conversation and we were hooked. And so we decided to come on the show.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. And you have the honour of being my second time having a threesome on the podcast. Actually, the first time where I've had my two guests in the same room together. Before I did it, they were in different rooms. You are the first pair to be on the screen together. So, yeah, fantastic.
And I just realized that it's episode 201, which makes three again.
Yes.
And going back to the magic number.
Oh, the magic number, yeah. Two and one and three. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Indeed. It's the 21st of November, so that doesn't count. There's no threes in there. Oh, no, 2 and 1. Yeah, 2 and 1. There we are. Yeah, 201, 21. Wow, we've got, the world is now converging on us. So where are you in the world? I never know where my guests are these days. It could be from anywhere.
We're in Port Leven in Cornwall.
Sounds idyllic and beautiful. Is that a fishing village or?
Yeah, it is. It's got a harbour and so forth. Of course, it's winter now. Well, it's getting into winter. So it's about 7 degrees outside, sunny, but cold, you know.
A little bit cold.
Blue sky.
I took the dog for a walk this morning.
It's a beautiful part of the world.
Oh, shivering. It is. Is it near where the Fisherman's Friends films were filmed around that area? Is that kind of the...
Yeah, yeah. But those were filmed up and down the coast, I think. So, yeah, I reckon they probably filmed some of it here. I mean, I say it's 7 degrees. Apparently, it feels like -2, according to the app on my phone. Does that mean we didn't go in the sea yesterday? No, it doesn't. We did go in the sea.
You went the sea? Oh, wow. You're 365 swimmers, are you? Every day in the sea?
I don't know about every day, but certainly. And when I say going in the sea, I'm not talking about in a wetsuit.
You're talking about trunks.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, yesterday we were looking out of the window and it looked stunning. Blue skies in fact, it was 3 in the afternoon. So the sun was coming down. The light was golden. And I said, it looks like we are in the Caribbean and inside is fairly warm. So just let's go and see what it's like. And it was beautiful, reinvigorating for sure.
What she's leaving out is that as soon as you step outside, you realize it looks like the Caribbean.
It doesn't feel like it.
Not at all.
So is this a swim? Is it a paddle? Is it just a dunk and back? Or are you hanging out there for an hour or so?
Yesterday it was a dunk and back. But normally you swim. I sink, so I don't actually swim. But you swim.
Yeah. And it was head in as well yesterday. I really needed to refresh my mind because I had a very sleepless night and night before. So it was good for me in that sense. It just kept me going through the day.
Well, I'm very impressed. As I've hinted to know, I've got a dog. Well, we've only had the dog about 8 weeks. So we're still in this new puppy territory. And getting up at early o'clock when she wants to go out for a wee and then having to take her for a walk at 7 o'clock, I've got to have a big overcoat and snooze and things now, and it's makes it a bit more pleasant. But yeah, I'm now experiencing weather that I probably most of my life I've avoided. But yeah, it's something to be said about starting the day or clearing your head and going for a walk and having the fresh air or getting in a massive plunge pool, the Atlantic plunge pool, I guess. Is it the Atlantic where you are?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, fascinating. We want to talk about bias, trauma, human connection, specializing in creating spaces where people can explore themselves deeply and honestly. So where did that come from? What was the spark and the inspiration?
Well, about 6 years ago, I was working at Falmouth University. I was teaching screenwriting. And then a few things happened over a fairly short period. I realized that I'm very mixed race and I'm South African. And when I say very mixed race, normally when you say mixed race, people think of white or Caucasian and, you know, another race. But in my case, I say very mixed because my ethnicity is very mixed. So I have a grandmother from Mozambique, another one from somewhere in India, a grandfather from Malaysia, and another grandfather from Holland. So it's a really deep mix. And anyway, I realized in my situation as I was sort of delivering these lectures that there was a whole lot of information the students were not available. It wasn't available to them. Well, at least it was available, but it wasn't showing up in the work. And if their work is to create something, in the same way that when you're working with an AI or an LLM, garbage in, garbage out. So if you put really decent information in, interesting things come out. And one of the things I realized is the students weren't exposed to other perspectives outside of the Western one. And I realized that there was potential in them that wasn't being realized because of that. Their experience of the world was getting smaller. And I went on to co-create a module called Belonging that ran in the fashion department at first, the Fashion and Textiles Institute. And then I translated it over to photography and to television, those modules, those courses. And necessarily because I don't think it's not like a wandering with some answers. You have to adapt to the context. And that's sort of a theme of what I do. So that's some of how I got to where we are.
Hmm.
And I started doing some of that work with other universities. So obviously I've got skin in the game because belonging is, for me, it starts with me belonging to myself and then how that ripples outwards. And it requires empathy, obviously, because if I have a good sense of my belonging myself, I can then start to find the limits of my empathy and so. But before this becomes a TED talk. Why don't we turn over?
What was the question? Now, why are we doing this? Personally, it's because life brought me here. Essentially, my background is coaching, but also energetic work. And why I started to do this work is because a family member was very mentally ill with an eating disorder. So I was caught up in that experience. And at some point, I realized that actually I was not helping anymore. I was hindering their recovery. So I had to look at myself and says, what's going on here? Why we're not making progress? So I started to look at my behaviors, and I realized that I was modeling what my mother did to me, which I never wanted to do with other people in my family. And I started to look at why I was doing that. I went into trauma, and then I had great self-awareness and insight. See how I was isolating myself from the rest of the world because of this. And then, to cut a long story, but it's thought, I went into training, started to do this work. and realize how much we isolate ourselves from the rest of the world because we need to protect ourselves. And then eventually, why are we doing this together? Because essentially we met on a dating app and we realized that, you know, in a conversation, we had a lot in common. And then as we got together, it felt like this is why we're here, because I have that kind of skill of helping people to create a safe space for them to just look at their traumas and their blocks, emotional blocks. And you have this ability of creating space and holding a conversation, very difficult conversations. And the title is Healing Through Belonging, if I remember well. And we are very much about collective healing. This is a collective experience. We can't heal in isolation. We'll heal as we co-regulate with each other.
I've heard many people say that you can't truly understand others until you understand yourself. And I always think you have to like yourself, you have to be aware of yourself before other people can like you as well. So I think finding self is really important. And I think what you're saying there, Adrian, about having this huge depth of your ethnicity and your, I would imagine you had to explore all of those different nuances. You mentioned your grandmothers come from and grandfathers come from different continents, and there's a whole range of people going back in time there. And you must have had to explore that to really try and understand where you are in the world. Is that right?
Yeah, and not just as a sort of cognitively and not just sort of looking at the sort of factual history. There are things, artifacts of that experience that are squishy, you know, that live in a recipe that somebody held onto, in a way of speaking, in various phrases. I mean, my father occasionally, if he talks about going to the doctor, he'll say Kwakzalver, which is sort of, that's his sort of Dutch, his father's Dutch heritage coming through. And my mother passed away in April. She had her sort of linguistic sort of idiosyncrasies as well. And those were carried from her mother and so on. And her father died when she was two. So she didn't have a one-to-one relationship with him, really. There's all of those things. And of course, I don't know if you know anything about Cape Town, which is where I'm from, but there's an area of Cape Town that's quite, well, a story from Cape Town about people being evicted from a specific area called District 6, which is, if you imagine the Table Mountain, the classic view of Table Mountain, it would have sat sort of nicely in the middle of the flat. Not the flatbed, but in front of the flatbed, because nobody lives on top of the mountain. But so my parents hadn't met at the time, but their families were evicted from this very multicultural area during apartheid. And I mean, I grew up towards the bottom end of the apartheid regime and then on into the new South Africa. So I left when I was 33, so I'd experienced some of that. So yeah, there's a lot of variation and flavor and a lot of spice in my ethnicity, but also, as I say, it's not just a fact, it's also a way of seeing the world, and it influences my relationships with time and all sorts of things. And it means, because I experienced that particular experience of being in South Africa at that time, you know, the way that I respond to various things is I could see how it was flavored by that upbringing. For instance, there are probably a handful of times in my life that I've walked up to a police officer because they are unsafe. Certainly the way I grew up, the police was unsafe. And so yeah, there's a lot that's informed by my lived experience, but I don't stop there. I mean, I'm curious about my life, but I'm also curious about the world. And to get back to sort of the belonging part, belonging and love are linked. So if you can find ways to love yourself or discover ways of loving yourself, because I don't think that's sort of endless.
Mm.
It becomes easier to love beyond yourself.
So, Sylvia, talk about belonging. Need and Belong is your organization. What is belonging?
I was thinking as you were asking a question to Adrian, why we're doing this work, right? Because when we met, I always consider myself a very inclusive person, very equal, very diverse, right? button was only when I was, you know, I started a biracial relationship, I realized that actually there were some emotions that were coming up for me. And of course, with my background as trauma and unconscious, you know, beliefs, everything started to bubble up. Like, oh my God, I actually mentally, I know that I'm inclusive and diverse, but actually in my body, I hold some experiences that are not quite aligned with the way I want to be. I want to show up. Yeah, I wasn't fully inclusive. I was, but really there was something that kind of needed to shift. And by the way, I'm on this journey. I haven't finished, you know, like processing all of this. So in terms of belonging, in our relationship, we cannot belong fully to each other, or we cannot belong fully to each other unless, until I move this. And also what showed me that when I go in the world and I look at, you know, black and brown people, different, you know, races, I didn't see the trauma, the conditioning from the trauma they have experienced. And now I have a fuller understanding what it means to be, in, you know, someone, not fully, actually, a better understanding to have a sense of what it's like for you to be you. It's not just you as an individual, but you also belonging to that culture. So belonging is, to answer your question, is getting to know yourself and also getting to know how others might experience you and the world.
It's really interesting what you're saying there about this awareness you've developed since meeting Adrian around what racism is and feels like, because I am a white person. My heritage is white and British. I see the world through my blinkers. I see the world through my lens. I don't know what it's like for you either as a couple or as an individual. And it's not until sometimes you open those doors and actually listen to somebody who's going through that that you truly understand. And it's not the big racist issues. It's the little, just the way people look at you, or I'm sure you find that people see you as a couple and there's a reaction to that as well. And it's like there's an assumption that the other person's going to be the same ethnicity as you. Now, I get it, where people assume the person who is with me is going to be of a certain sex or gender or appearance. People are judgmental without being cruel or mean about it. They're just making assumptions, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, again, as I said, it was only when I actually, when we started the relationship, certainly things were coming up. But when we went to South Africa, when I was outside my environment, the white people were the minority in that community. So I said, oh my God, this is how it feels not to be, you know, not to feel safe in, you know, and feel that you truly belong in that space. And we had white people looking at us because biracial relationship. We had black and brown people doing that as well. And it was like, wow, this is what it feels like when you're not feeling welcome. Although I did have my little flavor of not feeling welcome with Brexit because I'm Italian. I mean, been in the UK for 25 years. So I did have a little flavor, but still there is the whiteness makes me belong in a diff, you know, at the core, I belong, even though I'm from another country. So yeah, it just really, when we met, I'll tell you this story. We met on the app, and the first opening line was, my question to Adrian was, what is the best piece of advice that someone has given you? And your reply was?
It was, if you want to learn something, teach it.
And my reply to Adrian was, yes, I agree, but I take it a little deeper. If you want to learn something, experience it, and then teach it. And that is my mantra, right? Although, you know, my journey is ongoing as human beings, but I teach the work that we do is because we experience it. We experience it, what it feels like to be in a room with people and to feel lonely that you don't belong, because you don't belong to yourself in the first place. And this is why we're passionate about taking this stuff in the workplace. Because how many people feel displaced in the workplace, in places where they've been 20, 30, maybe 30 years working in that, and they just totally lost their soul in that place. And it just becomes a mechanical activity that you do every day to survive.
Pick up on something you just said there, and and I'm a quiet believer in this sort of this concept, is that you said about being lonely. I truly believe you can be, there's a being alone and being lonely, and you can be lonely in a room full of people, and you can be connected even when you're on your own. I also think it's the same as being the difference between included and belonging, or inclusion and belonging. You can be included but not belong, and it's trying to elevate yourself from being unwelcomed here. People accept me. I'm part of this. I get an invite. But when you arrive, do you belong? And that's a different feeling as well, isn't it? How it's almost like an upgrade, where you go, actually, you've included me, but actually, I'm part of this. This is me. This is who I am. This is, everything resonates. Everything feels comfortable here. And I think I always say, literally, lonely and alone, inclusion and belonging, they're different things we don't always think about.
You know, I feel like belonging is closer to a state of being than it is, it's something you become aware of after it's happened or as it's happening, not something you have to sort of prepare your mind for. You belong, it becomes part of the fabric. It's a truth that emerges rather than something you sort of create, and you can't perform it either. You know, in the same way you can't perform vulnerability. You know, you're either vulnerable or you are.
Yeah.
And
it's a bit like virginity. You either are or you aren't. You can't be a bit pregnant, can you?
No. there's a distinction I make between knowledge and information. And I use it to sort of kind of situate my empathy in a way, in that if I call knowledge information that I can contextualize in my lived experience, so I can talk about, you know, using a screwdriver, but I can't talk about having a child, you know, because I don't have the
organics
to be able to produce use a child and so many other things. I normally do a much more visceral version of that metaphor, literal metaphor, as part of some of the things I deliver, because it's sort of, I can sort of say, okay, well, that's information. I can be in the proximity of its own experience, but it's not my experience. You know, I can have space and time and care for it, but it's not my experience, and I can recognize that. And I think it's very important, because it can inform belonging, it can inform inclusion, you know.
I have something to add about that, and this is just literally insights coming through as we're having this conversation. This is the beauty, isn't it? Really, to have these deep conversations. That, again, like you say, information, if I don't have the experience, it's kind of all information. And at the same time, one of the elements that we bring in the workplace is nervous system education, and education about the emotions, and becoming into, you know, getting into coherence with the people around you. Because really, and this is part of the work that I do, is energetic work, getting into coherence with someone's energetic field and essentially the nervous system. We can really feel people, but we need to be present, fully present. And again, going back to the beginning, you need to be fully present with yourself before you can be fully present with others. And when you practice and clear your blocks, emotional blocks, then you can become even more attuned with someone else's experience at a nervous system level, at an energetic level. And there was something else that I wanted to add, which just disappeared from my mind, that links all together. But anyway, I'll come back to it.
Go back to, I mean, both of you can tackle this. You talked there about, so I can't understand your exact experience. I can hear you. I can get information about it, but I don't. So how can we build empathy through just having information? That's what we're trying to do here, isn't it? Well,
I think, so one of the things I do, for instance, and is I paint that information knowledge sort of line, and it's a wiggly sort of organic line rather than a dead straight one. I find that helpful, because it tells me that it helps me not center myself in that conversation of the experience I don't have, and that sort of kind of ironically helps me be more empathetic. And in a way, I call it the line of the limits of some of my empathy so that I can understand, and I don't mean a limit, it's more like a milestone or a guide. It shows me this is where my body stops experiencing something, and this is where my mind and my heart can take me slightly further. And knowing that is quite powerful for me, because it means that I can say, okay, my experience of not belonging and your experience of not belonging are not going to be the same, but there's a flavor of overlap, because not belonging has, there's some similarity. It's in the subjectivity that, you know, I always think of belonging as being highly subjective. So in terms of how we would deal with a client, for instance, I always think that the missing element in any definition of belonging is the client, because I don't go to, we don't go to them with prescribe how to or any of this thing. We go to discover what their context is and what it and how, you know, and my assumption is always that people will come to you with questions, have their own answers. And what we do is create space for them to realize their answers. We don't necessarily know the answers, but it's sort of let them emerge. But yes, I think empathy, I mean, I guess it's helpful to sort of want to have a very lovely, squishy, wavy, slightly imprecise definition, not a, like a cold, hard one, of what we mean by empathy in a given context. So, I mean, loosely speaking, I think, you know, we only have a sense that we have the same feeling of a feeling of what somebody else's experience is. And it's a feeling, not the feeling. And for me, the goal is important. Is it empathy so that I can take the experience, or is it empathy so that I can support the experience, you know, of somebody else? So the other person is in the center. I always think about that quite a lot.
Sorry. No, you're looking at me. I want to say something, yeah, before I forget. Mm-hmm. I'm in a right day with my memory today. But what I want you to say is, it's going to come back to me.
It's there. I can feel it floating in the air. You just got to grab it.
You just go, Joe, and just carry on.
Again, pick up some things that Adrian said there was around the, again, back to belonging. And you can't dictate belonging. You can't give belonging. You can't insist on it or even fix when it doesn't exist. It's that feeling you have inherently within you that you know. And it's more than just one thing. It's more than just the colour of the walls or the sofa you sit on. There's a whole vibe going on here. And it's very, you know, I think we said earlier, it's very binary. You either have it or you don't. And if you don't have it, it's not often not much you can do to suddenly co-create that. It has to evolve over time. And I imagine where you've both migrated to the UK, relocated from wherever you grew up, wherever you were educated, to this lovely little place in Cornwall. And you had to find that belongingness together as well, and in your community, and with your unique characteristics that come together. And that must have been a huge, great learning exercise for both of you to find that, wow, this place now feels safe, comfortable, and I can relax here, mostly. Yeah, I'm not saying absolutely, but mostly.
And what I want to say here is, like, it's the same. You described it beautifully. We belong every single day. Every single thing that we do is a choice, almost like a choice. I belong. It's a choice that we make. You know, we have decided that we belong to this conversation, right? And I could stay here and sit back and trying to be a bit more like, you know, in close with myself, and you could belong to each other, but me not belonging. But we choose to all belong to this conversation. And that's beautiful. And what came up for me, it's like a choice that we do every day. It's a moving process, because sometimes we feel like we think, oh, I need to, when we talk about you need to belong to yourself before you belong to others, we feel like it's one trip. And when we get to the stop, we got there. No, it's actually a constant choosing of belonging every single time. I need to choose that, you know, in this new relationship, there is another kind of sense of belonging, like I say, another extended family, because I have children. So it's, again, we are a different group. And we need to find our balance and what the belonging means. And belonging in a group means that I need to feel that I belong myself, but also need to give something so other people can feel that belong as well. So it was a very, very interesting process. But going back, I remember what I wanted to say about empathy and how we develop empathy, because we can mentalize. I can understand that you have a different opinion than mine, but that is different than feeling empathy. And my belief is if you develop empathy, if you work on your own traumas. Because until I hold my traumas and my boundaries to protect myself from what I perceive can be a danger, I cannot actually open my heart to others. And I cannot immerse myself in their experience. So this is why in leadership and a workplace, the very linear thinking structures where everybody's, they're on their own role and they just do it. And if they go step out of that role, there might be, they might lose the job, they might be criticized, all of this. That is fear-based, trauma-based experiences, environments. And I cannot belong if I'm constantly feeling under threat. So, yeah, empathy, again, it can be, like you say, Adrian, it can be a mental, it's got to be an experienced experience.
Yeah, a lot of our work is actually from the neck down. Because a lot of, speaking the Western sort of compulsion is to do everything cognitively, to experience your emotions as a thought exercise, to not really feel them in your body, to experience them and seat them in your body. Your body becomes the unsafe place and you end up performing. So in the workplace, one of the ways I describe it is that people sort of park their identities at the door, and that there's, I'm not saying that's unhealthy, but it becomes problematic because it's taking energy. What happens? The question is always, what happens if you can have a choice about how much of yourself you bring to work and offer to the work? What happens to the work? What happens to the context in which you're working, the people you're working with? What happens to the organization? I mean, there can be a lot of positive things and new challenges. But ultimately, I mean, one of the ways we put what we're doing is for people who want this, we would like to rehumanize the workplace and not let it be run so much by the linear, the logical, the spreadsheet, the outcome. But what happens if we treat it more like a garden that's being tended? Where we tend ourselves as well, where we offer things from who we are, and that's appreciated in ways that remind us and make us feel like we belong as humans, insofar as we want to, and this is the holy choice, is very important.
In our approach, we use different, we work at several levels, right? We work on the mental, because that's what people access, essentially, an emotional, also energetic level, because they're all interlinked. If we can get an example, like you say, people leave themselves at the door when they step into work, and that takes a lot of energy. It takes a lot of energy to get yourself doing the things that you don't want to do, even before you start doing the thing. There is a lot of energy. There's lots of resistance. But if you're aware and you say, okay, I'll just... And also what I wanted to bring in is a neuroscience type, aspect of it. The brain wants to save us. Its job is to protect us, right? So if I'm bringing myself into work and I don't want to be there, the brain is not present with me because it's trying to make me avoid the feelings of, the frustration and the resentment. But if you have a choice, I'm going to just bring 50% of myself into work and I leave my other 50%, looked after, cared for at home, emotionally, metaphorically, then the brain, already you're giving a message to the brain that you're not in danger. You're just doing something for the time being for 8 hours and then off you go at home. So there is a lot, and you need to meet the people where I'm at. Someone is very logical, you need to just enter through that door, through the logic, and then slowly bring them, like you say, from their head into the body, down below the neck. And this is why, like you say, Adrian, the missing experience and the missing ingredient is the client, is the person, is their friend that is talking to you, is the neighbor, whatever contact you're in.
Pick up on something you've both been talking about here. Is that we're going back to the feelings, as you say, below the neck. And what we often do in academia is, as you say, cerebral, it's above the neck. And belonging, inclusion, psychological safety, trust, all of these kind of things are below the neck. They're feelings. Do I feel safe? Do I feel belonging? Do I feel respected? That is very subjective in the eyes, ears, and feelings of the person who has it or not. And you say that's where the belonging kicks in. So you work with leaders. How do you move the leader from a cerebral, logical solution here into an empathy thing? Because sometimes people see empathy and feelings as weakness, especially when you're in certain academic or leadership models. We're all talking about the logic and we're learning stuff. But it's not that. Say it's the trauma, what's going on in people's lives, what they're feeling, their biases, the blind spot, everything that's going on. They're unpacking this. Their fight, flight, fear mechanism, their vagus nerves going crazy, pumping adrenaline, anxiety, all that stuff's going on, isn't it?
Well, one of the things that we made a choice about clients, we chose not to try to convert somebody to wanting to work with us. We chose to focus on people who are looking to make this shift, whether they have the language for it or not. We put things out and sort of just let them know that we exist so that they'll look at what we're offering and something will resonate with the direction they want to move in. So we're not trying to convert people who aren't sort of operating this way to move in this direction. We're looking for people who already sort of are curious. And curiosity then needs to be met with courage, as in they have to add courage to that and we have to be courageous as well to be able to persist in that. Because what we're doing is facilitation. It's not therapy. It's definitely not giving people answers. It's creating space for them to assemble their own compass and then learn how to use that compass and to adjust it as they need to. But yes, it's definitely their willingness, their employability, so to speak, to that process of shifting from the one way of being to another, that is, that's absolutely necessary. Because if somebody doesn't really want to do something, it's a battle for them, and it would be a battle for us as well.
From a nervous system perspective, like, you can't force anyone feel or do anything as a therapeutic coach. It's not going to happen because there is a protective mechanism that will kick into place, especially with logical people like leaders. They experience numbness for a reason. That's why, because they're protected. It's a protecting mechanism. So if someone is not ready for it, it will not be triggered. There are people that I can very good, like some aspects, some branches of NLP that can be very good at kind of pushing people towards a direction. We definitely not, I'm not, I haven't trained in NLP whatsoever because I don't believe in that. I believe that safe space and awareness is what people need to be able to come up with their own answers. So if we are in the room, because a leader might choose to say, okay, let's do this work in our organization, but there might be in someone else in the room who is not ready for it, right? What we do, we bring gentleness. We do this very slowly, just like going to the gym. The first day you go into the gym, you just look at the gym. You don't touch anything. The second day, you might be wearing, the gym clothes. And then the third day you start picking up things. So this is a very gentle process. And this is why we call it a trauma-informed approach. Trauma-informed is like belonging. It's not a mental thing. It's an attitude of the practitioner. You, Adrian, are very good at holding the space in the group. I am very good at noticing the slight changes in someone else, like even slight movement. When Adrian says something, I can see what is that person has been triggered, and then, not addressing individuals, but in the room, we can talk about that. We can pause and talk about that because someone is experiencing it. Other people in the room will be experiencing it because going back to the nervous system and the energetic fields, we are all connected. It's like when you in a room and someone enters the room and you feel, oh my God, I feel so uncomfortable now. What is it? Someone else come in with the nervous system dysregulated and every single one and every other person in the room is picking it up.
As you're both talking, I'm thinking here that the word courage came in earlier. What's also bouncing around my mind is that these are skills that not all of us possess. You know, certainly leaders don't possess all these skills, and radical empathy, even any empathy, is often not present. And I know leaders tend to be thinking about business objectives, getting reports out, hitting targets and numbers, and feelings and empathy can sometimes get in the way with that. You know, almost like many HR departments I speak to, it's all around policy, process, managing this, managing that. Do we put enough effort and training to develop leaders who are able to have the skill to engage with people at an emotional level, not just a logical level? You know, we think about, we've got our amygdala and our trigger part of our brain, we've got our prefrontal cortex. We need people to move into the prefrontal cortex, but also recognize that the feelings are buried deep in the back part of our brain, which is our reactive, because sometimes as a leader, we think, I don't want to open that box in case they react in a way that I can't handle. And that's what we talk about here, the trauma-related experiences. Getting into the hub of this, we need to be brave enough to get into the feelings where there's no right answer. It's all nebulous, shades of grey.
Well, there's certainly, having worked in policy contexts a few times, I've realized that often policy is about protecting organizations, with the organization as a sort of a legal organism, from these squishy spaces, these nebulous spaces. So you made, for instance, I was made redundant a few years ago, and there's the process of the redundancy as I experienced it, is the organization making sure they follow the law rather than centering the person who is potentially being made redundant, because the performance is that your redundancy is a possibility, but the reality is it's a certainty, you know. And so I have to, certainly with my race, my experience of lived experience of race, I am very practiced in living with paradoxes and contradictions, because I have to. It's a survival imperative. So to see that, I can see that, and also I love Gabor Mate's definition of trauma. He talks about it. It's not the thing that happens to you, but what happens to you as a result of the thing. So you disconnect from your body, your emotions, etc.
So it's the echo.
Yeah. He says the echo is the trauma. It's not the thing. And what I love about that is because what that inspired in me is to be able to see the trauma in the traumatizer. So, for instance, if we look at redundancy, the organization cuts off its own humanity and the people involved, because people have to talk to you in order to do this. The organization does not have a face. It's people who have to talk to you. They have to sort of suppress some of their humanity in order to have these conversations with you, that they know a performance, and then show you where the door is at some point, you know, in a way that somehow protects them. So that numbness protects them to some degree, and then they have to drive home, you know. And it's really, really interesting. So I don't sort of, and I haven't used the word victim once, because I feel like that suggests that the traumatizer isn't a victim either, because they certainly are, you know. So there's quite a dynamic there. But yes, I think it's really important to situate, to have awareness, self-awareness, because then you can realize, you know, one of the terms that's in various pieces of literature is metacognition. I, you know, the ability to be able to see yourself thinking, to observe yourself thinking. And I think you should also be able to observe yourself feeling, so that a feeling comes up and it's not completely running you, that you can see, oh, this feeling is happening, and I can observe the feeling. I can make choices about it, you know, and that choice might be to let the feeling be, but not let get out into the world as an action or words or any of those things.
That's a great word, metacognition. I completely understand what you're saying here. Is being able to step out of your body and look down on you and analyze what's going on in your mind, what's going on in your heart, your feelings, and then almost a bit like emotional intelligence, where you're able to understand and be self-aware of what's going on, and then you can start to get into the self-regulation, self-management, and adapt based on what you know. But if, I suppose if you're right in trauma, you're living it. You can't step back out of that. That's maybe some of the problem you're talking about there.
Yeah. And suddenly if you do all this without judgment. So to just see what is...
That's the hard bit, isn't it? We're judgmental people. We love to be right. We love to have opinions. We love to tell people what we think, don't we?
And that is the primal biology role of the brain, is to judge, is it safe, it is not. The problem is that we live, you know, I talk about there is primal biology and there is us as human being evolving in this, you know, in this world, like our consciousness is evolving. And there is like a gap, you know, there is a contradiction between the two. And self-awareness, that metacognition, be able to see what you're thinking, but also what you're feeling. We need to come up with a new word for that. Is the process to bridge that gap. But going back to the leaders, they're focused on productivity and profitability and numbers and stats. I mean, the system is crumbling, that we like it or not. Something needs to shift. AI's come in, and I think if you treat it properly, AI is in a way is a blessing because, as I said before, AI will solve is almost like a left brain kind of tool, helps you to solve, plan, and do everything. And what you left is space for creativity, is space for connect with people, is space to explore different opportunities. So this is why the passion for us is actually to help people. How can we help humans to actually capitalize on this AI venture instead of feeling threatened by it? And we talk about you can create it from two different spaces. You can create it from a place of fear, or you can create from a place of flow, of connection, of safety. The results are very different. Because if you can create from flow, you can actually connect and belong to the team because you feel safe. And actually, you can say, I've got a great idea, but my idea combined with yours actually is going to be even better. But when we are into, trauma responses and, this idea that, scarcity, we focus on creating solutions for ourselves, for our sake. So I think leaders will have to evolve. Some leaders will not and eventually will fade out, but the majority of us will need to embrace this. I mean, off sickness, quiet quitting, redundancy, burnout, costs a lot of money anyway.
And they affect leadership as well as... leaders burn out. Leaders quit quietly.
Leaders are led by somebody else. There's a hierarchy of leaders at some point.
Yeah. And so I think what's always important is to remember that everybody's human. You talk about sort of creating from fear. What happens when that happens is that you filter out things that won't get you to feel safe. Now, it doesn't mean that there's not immense possibility in those things. And I specifically didn't use the word value just then. Those things are just not imperative to your survival in the moment. And so you're throwing so many babies out with the bathwater. And when you're creating from flow, they all get to their time in the sun, and you can make choices that are better informed, that are deeper, that are more connected. And the choices become offerings rather than imperatives.
Huh.
Also, there's this distinction between the fear-based way of creating, of being, can be quite individualist focused, whereas the other is more collective focused. Because what helps us helps me, and what helps me helps us. And it's not that we lose distinction. It's not, you don't lose your identity. You need an identity in order to belong to the us. But the possibilities that happen when we're connected that way are just, they're exponential. As opposed to the individual just looking out for themselves. I mean, I've been certainly in work contexts where people have stolen my ideas for their own progress. And I always see those as missed opportunities for the opposite to happen, for all of us to move on.
Is there a demographic bias in some of these things? So I'm thinking, are men more likely to lack empathy than women? Or is it, if you've experienced marginalization, discrimination in the past, you're more likely to have more empathy about another person's situation? Can we generalize here at all? What good leaders tend to be women, tend to be overcome? You know, just have a view on that?
I think it's both. You can generalize, and yet you cannot. I think it's one of the paradoxes, you know, because again, it goes down to the individual experience. For me, to bring some woo-woo into the conversation, it's about balancing your feminine and masculine energy that we hold. You know, like generally, can generalize, the masculine is the provider, right? And the feminine is the protector, the kind of the energy that, you know, makes you feel safe and nurtured. And the masculine is like, I'm going to go out, hunt, come back and put the meat on the, next to the fire. And the feminine will cook the meat. You know, that kind of stuff. So it's a balance between us. In a Western society, we're driven from a masculine, very patriarchal way of doing things. And you see even women, you know, doing that in, you know, business women, founders, they drive businesses like men would do. Even if they come up and show up with a lipstick on, they're still driving from a masculine, you know, Western height orientation. And what was the question? And what was my point? To see, so there is an imbalance. There is an imbalance. I question myself, how do I want to run my business? Because I don't want to do it like the way that everybody else does. There are many people are shifting, actually. It's this big authenticity, and being authentic is a buzzword now, especially on LinkedIn, showing up and being vulnerable. Again, you can fake it, you know, you can come across vulnerable to a certain degree, and then it will show up anyway. But I think I lost my point. Someone save me.
I think what you were trying to say there was it's about getting in touch with your energy and recognizing that you need different energy sources. So as you say, the protector, the provider, and whatever your gender, your age, your demographic is, recognizing those different energies and needs in different times, and being able to authentically move in and out of energies and modes and styles and communication and adapt to interact with people in a way that resonates at the time. I think it's what you're trying to say. So it's skill here is self-awareness. And you say that metacognition, to be able to put yourself in a place where you are the most receptive communicator to listen and to assist at the time. To paraphrase what you're saying.
Yes, thank you for bringing me back to the center. And it's about self-awareness and also willingness. Am I willing to just do this? Because, you know, to the point that Adrian said, we want to work with people who want to, maybe don't know the answer, they don't know what they're looking for, but they feel like there is something different that is needed in the business and the organization. And there is that sense that the willingness, because when you open the Pandora's box, there is also a purging process that people need to go through. You know, and my clients said, yeah, we can do this work. But remember, after the session, the process continues. So you need to start to look at, you know, at uncomfortable new beliefs that come up. We might work on something, but something else will come up because it's a constant renewal process. That's the nature of nature. And we are nature. We constantly renew. We grow our hair. We cut them to grow. Skin, nails, you know. That is the thing.
I mean, fundamentally, we have to care deeply about the end result. Mm. If I'm having a conversation with you and I don't really care how you feel when you leave the room, that sets me up for an emotional failure, if you like, or a connection failure. If I deeply care that I want you to walk out of that room feeling enhanced, feeling valued, even though this is a tough conversation, even though I'm making you redundant, I can do it in a way where there's empathy and compassion and I'm helping with that trauma process. Sometimes I can just go, well, here's the bit of paper. Sorry, you're out tomorrow. Bye. Same conversation, just a different outcome planned, isn't it? So I think caring enough about how you interact, it's got to be the first stage. And until we get that I care enough feeling, we're never going to be able to take a helicopter view of the conversation and think what the outcomes are.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny when this is an artifact of race conversations. And one of the things I've learned to do and continue to learn to do is how to hold those conversations in a way that doesn't, that allows everyone into the conversation insofar as they choose to be or can be. And those are definitely two different things. Because you can really want to be in that conversation and not be able to. And one of the things that, one of the artifacts in the main is that somebody's response to something that's happened or somebody else's experience or somebody else's story becomes the center of the conversation rather than that experience. And it's the low hanging fruit here is to say that the white person cries and their tears become the conversation and their experience becomes the conversation. But that's the low hanging fruit. It can happen to anybody in that context because it then becomes about the feeling rather than the experience and whose feeling it is, you know, and it becomes about that person's empathy rather than
who's gaslighting who, who's more right.
It can be all those things. And for me, it's so important. The awareness has come up quite a few times in this conversation. That awareness, the things, you know, you go through a transformation, and I say transformation, I mean it in the sense that you choose to be a different way. And often that means letting go of things, and some things are very sticky. For instance, some of our work involves the inner child metaphor dialogue. The inner child's got very sticky fingers. You know, within that metaphor, there are parts of you that struggle because they want to be safe. They struggle to let go of control. So letting go of that is not an easy process. Eventually it is, but it is not an easy process. So being able to be sort of courageous enough to make those choices, to have the self-awareness, to see these things happening, it's a conversation with yourself, you know. And being better at having that conversation with yourself makes you a better everything. Better partner, better listener. I mean, I talk about deep listening as being able to hear yourself as well as the other person. Because if you can't do it in both directions, something's wrong. Because you can over-center the other person's experience. You need to be able to hear what's going on inside of you so that you can know which bits to offer or to withhold. So that deep listening is a really, really important aspect of our work. And from sort of creating context for that deep listening to happen is crucial.
I just want to go back to a question that you asked Joe, about there are different, some characteristics or some experiences, like people, black and brown people, do they experience more empathy because of what they've gone through? And the answer was yes and no. In my case, being criticized, overly criticized as a child, has given me, and feeling it, has given me the ability really to pick up on people when they retrieve because they feel criticized, right? As a practitioner, has given me. So yes, your childhood experience will shape the way some of your gifts, and you talk about, you know, growing up in South Africa, having to be able to, you know, you had to scan the environment around you to feel safe. It's now your gift of being able to hold this big space where all these people are and make room for everybody's, you know, everyone's emotion. So yes, experience will shape the way you show up. And at the same time, someone who's been traumatized as a child, this does not mean violence can be really emotional. Neglect is as traumatizing as being, you know, for some people, as anything else, as a car crash. They are hurt so much, they isolate themselves. The inner child is just close in. And some of these people will show up with narcissistic traits. They got so far in through that, on that path, that cannot see other people's point of view anymore. It's just about them. It's just about them. And I've been dealt with narcissists in my life, and you see them. They just go back to like childlike behavior. And there is a block. And some of them, they wear suits and, you know, ties, you know, some of these big children, which unfortunately is quite prevalent in the top leadership layers, really. It's quite prevalent.
A mantra that many professional speakers use is you speak from the scar, not from the wound. So if your wound is still open, it's still bleeding, it's still leaking, you need to heal yourself first, and then you can reflect back on that trauma, that wound of the past. So you have to work on yourself first. And because if you're trying to heal from that point where you're still hurting, you're going to bring that hurt into the conversation. So what you're saying there is it's really important that to heal thyself first, I think, is the key message. Understand thyself and not bring your trauma into somebody else's trauma.
You can't take anyone, we're talking about in the context of our practice, you can't take a client any deeper than you have been. And that, you know, and the business actually, you know, if someone's running a business, you can't take it as further than what you actually prepared to.
Yeah, and I think, in an implicit way, modeling is a big part of what we do, because we're navigating the territory we're trying to bring other people to. And that territory is alive. So you can't sort of wander through it and say, okay, well, I know what that is now, because it's shifting. The terrain's alive. And also who you are, you know, I often like to start a session with the understanding that the version of somebody that walks into the room is the version I'm dealing with.
Yes.
Rather than this person I know for 10 minutes or 20 years, or whatever it is who's coming into the room. It's the version of them. So if they were running 5 minutes late and they're harried, or there's a thought in there that's distracting them, or not, if they're happy, sad, all these things, that's who you're dealing with. And being able to sort of find people where they are, that's what I talk about, is finding the version of them that's in the room. So I don't bring my preconceptions of who they are or might be into that conversation. I can put those preconceptions aside and say, well, this is where they are.
I'm with you on that. And I encourage you to do that as well, where you're meeting people where they're at. And that, as you say, in that moment, if you're trying to correct behavior, you're trying to figure out actually what's going on in your life right now, what's happened? Where are you? Are you feeling relaxed? Are you feeling happy, stressed, sad? Because all of that is firing your brain, your emotional triggers are going, and you can never go logical. You can never go to the prefrontal cortex if people are still living in trauma or still living in whatever baggage they're carrying, as you say, into the room right now.
And we're not asking leaders to be therapists either. We're just asking them to be just aware enough to be able to see, there's something here I don't recognize, and then to become curious. Or offer curiosity to that, not just ask questions necessarily, because we're not asking them to be therapists. I mean, we're not therapists, but what we can do is facilitate space for exploration, for navigation. Yeah. And if somebody needs whatever they need, there are ways for them to get it. But until they recognize that need and accept that need, you know, you're nowhere.
We were talking to someone the other day about this conversation. He's a CEO of business, and he says, but I can't just, it's already difficult to run a business. I can't look after, think about everybody else, what all my team members feel. And the point is, you don't have to look after them. You need to provide them space. And this is what we're trying to bring to business, a space, opportunities for your own people to look at this stuff, to look at themselves, opportunities. Because we live 2/3 of our lives is work. Work needs to take a responsibility how much extracts from us. It's just a question of providing opportunity, not just, oh, I'll provide you with extra half an hour for a walk, or, you know, I put a plant in the office. That does a little bit, but the work is deep inside of us, really, rehumanizing the workplace, rehumanizing humans.
Sylvia, Adrian, we could talk all day. I mean, we've been chatting now for, over an hour and a half, and a bit of time in the green room as well. So it's been fascinating to get to know you both, and I love the conversation. I think we've got a lot of synergy in what we think about, and it's really powerful. And I'm very envious about your cold water swimming and your idyllic Cornwall life. It sounds perfect. How can people get hold of you?
Well, we have a website that's leadandbelong.com, and it's leadandbelong.com. And there's an email address. So it's info@leadandbelong.com. Again, info@leadandbelong.com. And we've got profiles on LinkedIn individually, and we're gently active there.
I'll put full details in the show notes. well, you have to spell your names out, both of you. It's for native English speakers, read the show notes to get the spelling, because Adrian is not spelled as you would imagine. And Sylvia is, obviously, but Adrian isn't. So, yeah, read the notes, look at the subtitles, the captions, and please do contact Adrian and Sylvia, because you'd love to hear from people, yeah?
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
We feel that work is needed.
Work is needed, for sure, definitely, definitely. Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. Today's discussion struck a chord. Consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.